Man, ain't nothing worse than waiting to get in the message than it's waiting to get the message. Boy, John Hagee and Joe Osteen and Jesse Duplantis ain't got nothing on Tennessee when it comes to raising that money. Woo! Damn! Come on down! Dig deep. Jesus is waiting for you. I'm here on the scholarship fund and I'm bragging about it. Yeah, I want you to know where your money went. He called me and asked me to come down to here, and he said, we'll bring you in on a scholarship fund. And I didn't know what that was, but now I do. I got in here on Wednesday and stayed at his house, and made me at home with his wife and his mother-in-law, and Clark picked me up at the airport. Brand new big Dodge truck, wall, right up here, right there at Tennessee's house. We went down to some restaurant, laid out a bunch of food, got some rest, got up in the morning. All them guys come over there and they started making coleslaw and showing up, and I felt like my home group. I felt at home. I felt at home. That's good. That's good stuff. See, the man took his money out of his pocket and put it in a big bowl in the kitchen. I watched it. And I watched it. And I watched it. And I didn't steal it. Oh, how little we change. I want to thank my friends from Columbus, Ohio for coming. Dogs Without a Roof are my brothers that came down and supported me, been here helping me out all weekend. I want to thank my friends from North Carolina. It just made me comfortable. Clark's going to take me back tomorrow. I've got all my... When you do this stuff, when you come out here, well, two things are important. The guy picks you up, and the guy takes you back. That's real important. And I'm fortunate I get to do this a lot, and you don't always know who's going to take you back. You may have a limo pick you up, but after you talk, you may ride back in a Jeep. Notice they get the money before they have you talk. Yeah. Well, the most important thing that I can tell you is that I'm not taking a drink of alcohol, nor have I used any kind of narcotics since May 11, 1976. And for that, I'm very grateful. I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to be sober. You bet. I want Taper to know that I watch the clock. I'm not a 2CD guy. The Tapers have a list of people that are 2CD people, and I don't want to be on that list. I'll tell you, no, I don't do that. They'll push pause at 72 minutes, and then you can talk as long as you want to. Taper told me, he says, you want me to take the first 80 minutes or the last 80 minutes of your talk? Now, you can only sit in them seats so long, and Tennessee's already taken an hour up, so I know you're going to be bussing to get to the ice cream social. You got yesterday's ice cream over there in the freezer. Thawed out and heated her up and iced her down. And have a bonfire meeting in the rain. Isn't that exciting? Man, you all go out behind the barn to watch a monkey dance if you thought there was going to be any excitement with it, wouldn't you? I love alcoholics. I love alcohol. Watching alcoholics are my entertainment. I love it. I enjoy it. I'm grateful for my sobriety. If my sobriety wasn't fun, I wouldn't do it. I didn't come here to turn it off. I came here to turn it on. And I ain't done nothing but that ever since the very day I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's been a gradual spiritual growth, but it's got better and better and better and better. I'm not once going to come tell you some story of tragedy and doom and gloom and failure for the last 33 years and 8 months. No. No. It's got better and better and better and better and better. I didn't always know that, but it's got better and better and better and better. And I'm grateful for it. Eternally grateful. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or not, but when I had my first drink, an alcoholic was born. And I had my first drink at a very early age. I grew up out in the Texas-Oklahoma panhandle where the men are men and the sheep are unscared. I'm a fifth generation alcoholic. My daddy was an alcoholic. His daddy was an alcoholic. His dad was an alcoholic, and so on. But it isn't necessary to come from that kind of stock. But I did. And that doesn't make me an alcoholic, but I'm at least a fifth generation alcoholic. And one of the reasons that I try to continue to carry on the recovery in my life is that maybe, just maybe, the chain is broken. Just maybe the chain is broken. Maybe my daughter and my two granddaughters will not have to carry on that family tradition. My daughter's 33 years and 8 months in the program of Al-Anon. My wife's 33 years and 8 months in the program of Al-Anon. And I'm 33 years and 8 months in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There has not been any time off for good behavior. There hasn't been any gaps, no sabbaticals, no vacation. Every day for 33 years and 8 months. Every day. All of us. And there's a reason for that. The reason for that is because the pain that we went through prior to getting here is the thing that makes us stay here. And the gratitude of what we get here is what we get every day. A blessing. A blessing. See? And I had my first drink at a very early age. And I grew up in a part of the country where you could get a driver's license when you were 12. I had a driver's license, a farm permit, when I was 12 years old. And in 1952, I was locked up in an institution for, I had been driving a car, and I was drinking. There were some guys in the car. I went down an alley, back down an alley, and I ran over a kid running behind the car. His mom was standing on the porch watching me, and I broke his leg. He's flopping around out there. I panicked, whatever. And I put the car in gear, and I drove off and broke his other leg, left the scene of the accident. A short time later, they made the big capture, and I was locked up in 1952, almost 1953, till 1955, in an institution with other boys, and there was barbed wire around it. It wasn't any big-time penitentiary or nothing like that. A bunch of boys that had been in trouble, locked up. And it was ex-military men ran this institution. I functioned very well in that institution, by the way, and I learned some good things. I learned it don't make no difference whether you're pitching or catching, you're still playing ball. You'll get that in a minute. I didn't get hurt in there. Matter of fact, I actually learned some things that have helped me survive in Alcoholics Anonymous while I was in there. See? I got out of there in 1955. Went down to Galveston, Texas, and I met this little sweet thing, and I sweet-talked her and smooth-talked her, and her daddy's one of the 10 richest men in the United States, because I may be sick, but I ain't stupid. And I sweet-talked her, and I was buff and tough, and we got married in Galveston, Texas, had a big wedding, people brought all kinds of stuff, all kinds of loot come in. In 1959, I got in Fort Worth, Texas. I got in another car accident, drunk, loaded. Left the scene of an accident with bodily injury. They made the big capture. That car that I'd borrowed from somebody had some outside issues in the trunk. And they made the big capture and drove me in jail in Fort Worth, Texas. And my father-in-law come to see me and he said, "I got a lot of money." And I said, "I know that." He said, "You know why I got a lot of money?" I said, "No." He said, "'Cause I don't make bad investments. And you're a bad investment." And they annulled me. I didn't know that. I didn't know what that meant, but it was the beginning of my abandonment issues. I guarantee you that come more and more and more as I went on. Anyway, I went over and did a little time over in Huntsville. And got to learn some more things. Some exciting things in there. And did a little time over there. They didn't have anger management and ACDC and bipolar and uncool. And they just, you did your time, baby, and you better have your butt against the wall. Love the one you're with. That's what I learned. It didn't hurt me. I learned some things in there that helped me survive in AA. Yeah. Yeah. I got out of there, I got $100 in a new suit, got me a fifth of drink of whiskey, got on a train, and I called my two very best friends, Oily and Goose, and they were up in Amarillo, Texas, and I said, I'll be in. I'm on a train, and picked me up, and I had my I got my jailhouse suit and $100. I bought a fifth of whiskey, and I did my first four step. I didn't know that's what I was doing, but I started drinking that thinking whiskey, and I looked back over my life, and I need to stay out of them honky-tonks. I need to stay away from them sick, crazy women. I need to stay away from them outlaw boys. I need to stay out of them fast cars. Over and over and over again, the train pulled in. Oily and Goose is there. They had a jar full of bennies. I took a handful of bennies, took a big shot of whiskey. It blew me back against the wall. I fell down, jumped. Damn, that's the best stuff I ever had in my life. Let's get it all. Anticipation. I got higher off of anticipation than it did the actual thrill. We got in the car and went down to Wolf Creek. We got down to Wolf Creek and they was having a dance down at Wolf Creek. There were no cops down in Wolf Creek. And I come in there at intermission, grabbed a Coke bottle, rolled it up and bumped the stage, and I said, let the meanest sucker in the house bring that back. I'm out. And it looked like a stampede coming my direction. Them old hairy-legged boys come off that wall, and I may be sick, I ain't stupid. The first drunk at the head, I hit him as hard as I could, and then I ducked into the woman's restroom. Yeah. I went into the woman's restroom. There was a woman standing there. I said, tell me when the fight's over. She said, okay. Pretty soon she come in and said, the fight's over. You can come out now. And I come out and the band was playing. She is handy and I'm quick studying. I said, you want to dance? Yeah. I said, where you been? She said, where you been? I said, I just got out of the penitentiary. She said, I just got out of an unwed mother's home. I said, why don't we go together and give two people a break? And we did. We did. Well, I'm a quick study. One quick dance, I found out she had a car, a driver's license, money in the bank, place to stay, none of which did I have. I said, come with me, baby. I'll take you places you've never been before. You may not want to go, but hell, I'll take you anyway. We started dating. 2 weeks. We dated for 2 weeks, and people in that community nicknamed us Hatchet and Hammer. It was so absolutely violent, it had to be love. It couldn't have been nothing else. I mean, we just beat the hell out of each other and called it foreplay. Just, I mean, that woman's violent. She finished the fight I started. People, well-meaning people, would come over to my house, wanted to get us to go to church or something. We'd have a big fight and beat the hell out of them. They'd go off crazy down the street and we'd go to bed and make out. Crazy. She got pregnant and said I was the father. I don't remember that. I must have been crossing over an invisible line when that happened. But hell, I'm a player. I'm a player. We got married. Got married in Amarillo. The preacher's drunk. I told him I'd give him 50 and I stiffed him for 30. I didn't think it'd last. We set out the life of a happy, loving couple. And I kept getting in trouble. I get in trouble. Everywhere I go, I get in trouble. All the character defects of all the drunks in my family rolled down into me. I was my family's best, worst example. I didn't know. I didn't drink because I was stupid or ugly. I drank because I wanted to drink. I like to drink. See? I like the effect of alcohol. See? And it says that it will affect you to the point that you cannot distinguish the difference between true and false, right or wrong. That's also the definition of a sociopath. Which I much like much better than being drunk. Well, I got in trouble, and it's time to leave. I know when it's time to leave, so I loaded everybody up. My friend Lon Shorty told me to get me a job on a ranch 40 miles west of Long Beach, California. That's ocean. But a guy named Lion Shorty wouldn't lie to you, would he? Huh? Oh, ye of little faith. I loaded everything up in the station wagon, had my wife and my kid and my dog and my cat, and everything looked like the grapes of wrath. And away we go. I left Oklahoma City. My friend got me a prescription filled in a baggie. And I started eating horse tranquilizers and elephant tranquilizers and drinking. And down the road we go, knocked the mirror off the right side of the car. She had to hang out, tell me what was over there. Dog would stand behind me and drool all over the back of my neck. Truck would go by and the dog would chase the truck all the way down at the end of the Stagison wagon, hit the back window, fall on the cat. They'd have a dog and cat fight. The kid would start bawling. She'd start bitching. And I drank one day at a time. One day at a time for 30 days. Took me 30 days to go from Oklahoma City to L.A. Most people can do it in three, but I was lost a lot. Yeah, I went through Arizona to Petrified Forest. I was looking at a piece of wood, been there a long time. God said, what are you doing? I said, I'm looking at this wood, been here a long time. He said, no, that's a dog turd. It was here yesterday. It's just a disease of perception. Well, I got to California. A friend of mine helped me get this place. Moved into this house. Bunch of hippies lived on one side of me and a motorcycle gang lived on the other side of me. Got a deal on the house. Nobody lived there in a while. I've never seen nothing like them hippies, man. They was dropping acid, taking their clothes off, laying naked in the front yard, watching the sun come up and go down. I never seen nothing like that down in Texas. But I need some new friends. Oil and Goose is back over there. So I went over to that house and there was a guy named Doc and a guy named Professor. And they had the answers to all my questions. And they gave me some of that acid. And we went to see the movie 2001. And we had a trip. Said, be careful, you'll have a bad trip. Man, my trips ain't even good unless they're bad. Well, I got a job. I went off. I stayed gone. I come home, bring all them guys home with me. Come on over to my house. You don't want to go home and fight with your wife? Come over to my house and watch me fight with mine. Hell yeah. Better than gun smoke. My wife took it up carrying this butcher knife, big old butcher knife, and she'd wave that knife around. She'd stick that knife right in my face. I like guns myself. I had a .44 Magnum, 2-inch barrel, had a hole the size of a cannon in it. I'd stick it right on her nose. I'd say, if you don't shut up, I'm going to shoot you. She'd stick that knife in my stomach, and she'd say, go ahead. Go ahead. I said, if I shoot you, you're dead. She said, I know, but when the bullet hits me, it'll knock me back, the knife will go forward, and you'll die too. You know, sick women don't need to train for that. They don't need boot camp for that. It comes intuitively. Yeah. I passed out on her one time, 15 minutes into a two-hour conversation. Had an old shirt on, and she stabbed me all over my back with that old knife. I come to her and said, oh, God, something's wrong with my back. She said, oh, let me see. She pulled my shirt up and said, you broken out of agony in the back drinking that Rock Gov whiskey. Said, let me get the rubbing alcohol. Perpetual revenge, baby. Perpetual revenge. She loved every ooh and ah. Yeah. Screech owl, man. She's just yelling and screaming all the time. One time, I invited some people from the church to come over. I said, you got to clean the house. You got people coming from the church. You got this old Electrolux vacuum sweeper out there. Big old long hose and a chrome tube. And I started yelling at her, and she pulled that hose off there, broke every window out of the house with that hose. And the people from the church came out, we're just sitting in there. Kind of breezy in here, ain't it, huh? What, you don't like it? What are you looking at? You know, we run them off. You know, then we went to bed and made out. You know. I'd get baptized all the time. They'd always come over and want me to get saved. I needed to be saved. One day, my little girl, she would come down and go baptize with me. And one day, my little girl come out and said, Daddy, look at my skin. My skin looks like a prune. I said, why? She said, I've been going down in that holy water so much with you, it's turning my skin like a prune. I'm not going with you no more. And you know, I look back on that. The only thing my family had when we went to church was the house of God that they believed in. The only thing they had. The only thing we're holding on to. And I destroyed that because I defied that. I defied that. Everybody in that church would be praying that I didn't drink, including me. And I would drink right on the premises. Drink again. And stand there with my bottle and defy God. See? And I look back on that, my amends. I had to make amends to my little girl and my wife for defying God in the only place that they could go to worship. We rob a little pieces of people's souls. We rob a little pieces of people's souls as we go down the way. I know what it's like to stand in my kitchen early in the morning, hanging on to a bottle of vodka. Look down the hallway, a little 9-year-old girl standing at the end of that hallway. She's got her chin on her chest and hairs in her face. She looks like a wounded animal. And I'm drinking that vodka early in the morning. And she didn't come down there and say, "Daddy, would you come play with me?" She just wanted to know which direction I was going so she could go the other way. And I'd turn around, take a drink out of that bottle, and when I looked back, she'd be gone. I didn't have to have a drink because I was ashamed. Hell! Come with me, I'll take you way past shame, Slick. Way past shame. I know what it's like to wake up in the middle of the night and look down on that lady, the mother of my child, and see that she's got a black eye or a busted lip. And I know I had something to do with it. And I run down a hallway and put my head down next to that little girl to see if she's breathing. See if she's breathing. But it's just a matter of time. So somebody's going to go away. I know what it's like to stand in front of a courtroom, stand in front of a judge, and the judge is talking to me about me. And he's telling me, "You live like an animal, you act like an animal, you defend yourself like an animal." And he let me go, he let me walk. I killed a man with my bare hands. He was dead before he hit the ground. And he let me go. Justifiable homicide. Self-defense. They let me go. They let me walk out of there. And the arrogance that I'd won, my brother sitting in the wings, I won. I'm a cut above. And yet in the middle of the night, when I'd have those pictures and those frames come back to my mind, I would wake up in the middle of the night and run down the hallway and put my head down next to that little girl and see if she's still breathing. Because it's just a matter of time till I kill them. Because they love me. Because they love me. And I hate me. I hate me. I loathe me. I became so evil. I became so evil with this disease that I didn't believe that I would ever be able to come back from the evil. I might be able to get sober. I might be able to get clean. But I became so evil. So evil and so dark that I didn't believe I could ever come back. I ended up in front of a judge, and he was talking to me about me, and he had the right guy. And through a series of events, he sentenced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what that was. It was 1970. And a man came into that courtroom, and they unhooked me, and he took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My house was painted 4 different colors. Because I had good intentions, but lost interest easy. The family wagon was a baby poop brown Pinto that went down the road crooked, had a hole in the muffler and no reverse. You had to drive through the neighbor's yard and pull up in front of the house. That was her work car. My wife wore a beehive hairdo with a can and a half of spray net in it. And the window was half down or half up, and so her hair always leaned. My kid had an old coat on with Easter egg. Old rotten eggs in it. She had hair down in her face. She looked like a wounded animal. My dog had chewed all the hair off his body. Everywhere his mouth had reached, she looked like a laughing hyena. Had dry mouth. I affected everybody, baby. Dry mouth, and his tail twitched. And he had a twitch. The cat had a permanent puff tail. My wife come home and said, "We're going to AA meeting. Get up." He stuck me that knife. I crawled up. I'd been in a fight, and the guy hit me in the head with a crescent wrench. I had this big old blood-soaked earmuff on. I had long hair, long beard. Traveling pretty light, really. And we go out and get in the old Pinto, got the dog lick and hair all over the windows, and the dog and the cat got in there, and the kid's in the back, and she's in there, and we drive over in front of this church, had a big AA sign, and I looked in there, much like tonight, people sitting in there, and I thought, well, I've sunk to the bottom now. If my friends see me going in here, they'll never have nothing to do with me again. That's called low bottom snobbery, baby. I don't care where you come from. That's low bottom snobbery. My wife sensed my approach avoidance, and she stuck that knife in my side and said, get out. What time's the meeting over? I said, the meeting's over at 10. I said, I'm telling you something, Mace. If your ass comes out the door before 10, I'm going to gut you. Now, you can keep me in an AA meeting. You got a crazy woman circling the perimeter out there with a 12-inch butcher knife. They didn't ask me if I needed a sponsor. She was out there in the pen over. Didn't need no book. Nobody asked me anything. Nobody told me nothing. I went to one meeting a week for several weeks to beat the deal down at the courthouse. I didn't drink, didn't use us to dry as a fire hazard. Laid over, beat the deal at the courthouse. By then, she let me drive. I went by that AA meeting, stopped off some of them old fools. I said, I ain't coming back here anymore. And they said, you must be going to go to B&B. I said, what's that? They said, I don't know, but where you're going, it ain't AA. And I got drunk. I got drunk. And I got drunk and I got sober. And I got drunk and I got sober. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, drunk, drank your coffee, sobered up in a meeting. Sometimes I'd go sober and a break, go get drunk. Come back, sit in a meeting. One time I came out of a blackout in AA meeting. That's scary. I would have left, but I didn't know who brought me. But it never gets better. It always gets worse, and then it gets worser. And then it gets worser. I would go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would hear the answer. I would hear them talk about God. I hear them talk about cease fighting everything and everybody. I would hear them talk about the way to treat my family. I'd hear them talk about a way to live. I'd hear that. And I would go home to this insane house. This insane house. This drunk house. And I'd go in that house, and I'd tell my wife, we got to quit fighting. She said, what? I said, we got to quit fighting. She'd take one step closer. I said, get out of my face. I said, I can't fight with you anymore. She'd take one step closer. She'd take one more step, I'm going to hit you. She'd take one more step, bam, and I'd be drunk. And I'd go back to meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd honk and sniff on the ladies over at that meeting. I'd go home. I said, I'm horny. Get in the bedroom. She'd say, you ain't made love to me in years, you stinking, filthy drunk. I said, well, it seemed like you enjoyed it a couple of times. She said, no, you have raped me for years. So we had a fight over who was whose Laura companion. And I would have to leave and go down on Anaheim Street in Long Beach with the ladies who understood me and get drunk again. And I would come back and I'd go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, we got to handle your money, whatever you got to do. And I'd go home and she'd say, I want some money. I said, all right, I'll give you a check. Now I'm the kind of guy who puts $100 in eight banks and writes $8,000 worth of checks. My wife went to jail many times because of my check. So for me to say, I'll give you a check, that's fighting words. Have a big fight, I'd go down to the liquor store, write a hot check, get a bottle, get drunk again. See, the same me will always drink. And I can't stay sober in an environment where I drank. And you see, no matter whether I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was no change in that home. It was still sick. And I would go back to that sick, sick environment. And there was no recovery. I was supposed to deliver some cocaine for some people. And I owed them money. And so I made a deal to do it. I picked up a vehicle in Los Angeles. Took off from Los Angeles. Got up about Santa Maria. I'd got me a quarter of whiskey. Quarter of whiskey. Old Crow. I drank a half quart of whiskey. I got up to Santa Maria and I had a good idea. I said, I think I'll steal the coke. So I hooked a right and went inland and hid the coke. I drank the other half of that quart of whiskey, went and hid out in this old place over there and forgot where I hid the coke. That's how I know I'm an alcoholic, not an addict. I short time later, I come to and I recognized I was in trouble. Big trouble. And so I went back home, and through a series of events, some people in Alcoholics Anonymous who had seen me, I reached out, I asked for help, and these people came and captured me and put me in a detox. 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 Nothing. Nothing. I said, how about some Valium and some hard candy? Nope. Nothing. Eat a banana. You need potassium. I take 3 steps and laugh and 3 steps and cry. But I felt safe. I felt safe. And people from hospital and institution committee came in there. And little by little, I felt safe. And I'm in this detox. The amazing thing, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And my doctor in this detox was Dr. Paul Olliger. The man of stories in a big book. He was writing that story when I went in there. And he was my doctor. And you can't BS a guy like that. He read my mail. And he took me and scooped me up. And he helped me detox. I don't ever want to detox again. Ever. 11 days clean and sober. I detox from some drugs I had him. And so on and so forth for 30 days, 60 days. Thank God they kept me in there. They kept me in there. They kept me in there until my body could detox. Dr. Paul and his wife Max went and got my wife and my daughter and took them down on an Alateen and got them help. Max took my wife and put her in Al-Anon and said, you've got to go to Al-Anon. And my wife said, I don't need nothing. He's sick. And Paul said, look, I've heard nothing but profanity come out of your mouth ever since I've been around you. You need help. And my wife went to the program the same as I did. And we joined as a family. Family recovery. Family recovery. We get sick as a family. Family recovery. After a few days, the guy came in there and said, I'm your sponsor. I said, really, what's that? He said, it's somebody that'll help run your life. So an idiot won't be running it. I said, really, who's that? He said, you. Huh. I said, I hate you. He said, that's good, I hate you. He said, hating me is not a requirement, but it's okay. He said, my name's Rotten Ron. And he was rotten. He was rotten, rotten, rotten. They didn't call him Rotten Ron because he was sweet. He was rotten. He said, get in the car. Had an old box van. Had a bunch of plastic milk crates on it. 3 or 4 big old hamburgers in this van. Grab a crate. He'd take off. Down the street we'd go. Slide around. Hit a light. Boom. We'd all slam up on one end of that thing. I remember one time, he hit a light and I slid right up between him and this other guy in the captain's chairs. I said, I killed a man with my bare hands. He said, I don't care. He took off and we all slid to the back and a 300-pound newcomer fell on top of me. And I would have choked him to death, but I was crying. He was so proud of him. And it mean to me. Fifty-two days sober, I remember where I hid the coke. Whoa! Hey! I didn't get 3 newcomers and my sponsor and go give it back or flush it in the toilet to call the people, said I don't know where it is. And I met them and they got their stuff. And I walked across the parking lot and they didn't blow a hole in me the size of a cannon, and I knew they could have. And it taught me the first thing I ever learned in Alcoholics Anonymous in sobriety. That every good thing is preceded by a wall of fear. And you must walk through the walls of fear to get to the other side. Some are short, some are long. And I walked through that wall of fear. You see, fear was my partner. I drove fear like a fast car. Fear to some people makes them hunker in the corner and they hunker down like an old mule. Fear, I drove it like a fast car, charged with that fear. Ran through the lives of others. And I recognize I'm going to have to walk through those walls of fear. And they told me, hope, you can have hope. Hope is a vision beyond your present circumstances. And sitting in that detox, sitting in those meetings as a newcomer, I had hope. Because I heard hope from other people. I heard them talk about hope. And the actions it took, faith without works is dead. And they got me busy. They got me busy. My wife and daughter got busy in their program, and we always had a program. The one rule we had in our house, you had to have a sponsor to be in, to live in that house. You couldn't live in that house. My daughter had to go to Alateen. I told her, I've got to go to AA. You're going to Alateen. Your mama's going to Al-Anon. You don't have a choice. She was young enough to be intimidated. I think the most hideous thing that I see in alcoholics, and I'm some alcoholics sober up, so I don't know, I've hurt my kids. I don't know about Alateen. I don't want to take them there. How can you be so hypocritical to think that you come here to find your God and deny your child to find theirs in an Alateen room? You bet your ass. It's family recovery. And those children get their higher power from children. I'll never forget, my daughter came home and she was lit up like a Roman candle. Lit up like a Roman candle. She'd gone to that meeting and some little beat up girl come over there and ask her to be her sponsor. Ask her to be her sponsor. And she was excited. She was excited. And those things were the things that she did that forgave me. She had more problems with her mother than she did me, really. Because I'm the drunk, and when I sober up and I start doing things. But what about Mom? Them crazy women that aren't alcoholic, it takes them about a year and a half to hit a bottom after the alcoholic sobers up. Because it takes about a year and a half before they have to quit blaming you because you're sober and you're not doing those things. And my wife hit a bottom. And they told her she could drink. She liked a little wine with pippin apple. Now, they told her, I can't do nothing about that. She went to an office party and drank part of a margarita and came home. Had a little glow on. I said, you went and drank, didn't you? She said, yes, I did, and had fun. And I'm going to go lead an Al-Anon meeting. I said, well, when you come home, I'm going to strap your ass down to an anthill, pour honey on you, and watch them eat you. Yeah. The one thing I can't do is drink. Every couple that I know where one of them's sober and the other is drinking, there's trade-offs. There's trade-offs, baby, you bet your ass. Because the one thing I can't do is drink. I can't drink. My wife went and did an inventory with her sponsor, came home, said, I'm never going to drink again. My wife ain't drank in 33 years. She said, why would I want to put something in me that has caused us so much trouble? And she quit. Boy, that pissed me off. How can you just quit? That ain't right. Quit. See? She went and worked the steps and didn't die. So I had to do them. My sponsor said, here, come here. He got a matchbook. He took the matches out of it. Paper clip out. Got a little golf pencil. And he said, here, do your four step. I said, no, I need a bigger piece of paper than that. He said, no, let me help you. He said, number one, you're a liar. Number two, you're a cheat. Number three, you're a sneak. Number four, you're a coward. I said, give me that thing. I'll work that step. And I went and did an immoral inventory, a fearful inventory. I did a sex inventory with an Eskimo. They do some weird stuff up there on the tundra, let me tell you, baby. But I did it. I did it. And I gave it my all. And little by little, I started changing. I started changing. I could recognize the difference between right and wrong. I didn't have to react to things. I wanted to stay sober. I wanted to do the next right thing. I wanted to make amends. I owed $250,000 to people. You can't write them a letter and say, I'll send you $100 a month. I went to this guy I knew had all this money, and I said, I'm sober. He said, I heard. I need some money. I got some things I can put up as collateral, but I need some money, about $250,000. When we were little boys, me and this little rich kid was down in the park and had knickers on. He was going around, and I jerked his pants down in front of the girls, and my folks made me apologize. So now here he is, the banker, and I'm asking him for $250,000, and he says to me, remember that day when we was down in the park and you pulled my pants down? Yeah. He said, I've never forgotten that. He took a checkbook and a pen across the table at me and said, start writing checks, get the money you want. When you're done, let me know. And I'll set up a payment plan And if you miss one payment, I'm going to kill you. Hey, give me a deal. Oh, you have little faith. I got that thing and I went and paid them people. And I started making a payment plan with that guy. Took me 14 years to pay that money back. I paid it back. I didn't have an overwhelming good feeling about it because I didn't have nothing to show for it. I can pull up in front of a meeting in a new Mercedes or something and I stole the money, but at least I got a Mercedes I can brag about. But I owed $250,000. I had nothing to show for it. And I paid it back. The amazing thing, and the reason I share that, is simply this. By the time I paid that money back, I had worked to pay that money back and worked to improve myself to pay that money back and took care of my wife and my family and got to a point by the time I was 14 years sober, I was making 10 times more money than I ever would if I'd have sat on my ass and let that debt go flat. I worked myself up by making that amends to a point of self-worth that I could make a living and make a good one. So I'm forever grateful they made me pay that money back. On the last payment, right before Christmas, going to be a lean Christmas. I called that guy and I said, going to be a lean Christmas, but I can make that payment. He said, what did I tell you? I said, you told me if I miss a payment, you're going to kill me. He said, you got one more payment. Make it. I couldn't cut a deal. And I made the payment. And I got going in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got my relationship with my family. And I'm making amends. And I'm going to meetings. And I'm setting up chairs. And I'm washing the cups. And I'm working the steps. And I'm reading the tradition. And I'm going with the old timers. I'm washing their cars. I'm greeting people at the door. I'm sober. I'm 3 years sober. I'm so sober. I was so sober, I was about ready to implode. I'm sober. My wife's sponsor said, what if he's as good as he's ever going to get? My wife said, I'll take it. He was better than he was. I was. I was so sober. I was bleeding. I was hemorrhaging inside. I was bleeding out my ass, my ears, my nose. I was sober. I've done it all. God's moved into my life. I bled 9 pints of blood. I think you only have 13, huh? And I ended up in an emergency room. And I was laying in the emergency room. The doctor came in and said, we had to put 9 pints of blood back in him. Said, you know, if he would have sneezed, he would have had brain damage. And my wife said, how in the hell would we have known the difference? And all these people in Alcoholics Anonymous came by and said, don't die, we love you. Fuck you. Take your happy face and get on down to your meeting. And they came in and said, love you, we love you. When you're weak, we love you. And some big old nurse come in there and did a bone marrow test in my pelvis. Torture. They finally said, we can't find nothing wrong with him. And they let me go. I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they made me secretary of a meeting, Sunday morning meeting. All these people came to the Sunday morning meeting. They made me the secretary, treasurer, and the cake lady all at once. And I go in here and count the money. I'd steal some money and put an IOU in there. Hug people. They'd come get their cake. I have to hug them. I don't hug men. I don't want to hug men. You better let go of me. Guy said, when you put your arms around, God embraces you, and God's in the midst. I said, if you let go of me, I'm going to knee you right where it hurts. Let go of me. I had so many guns on me. If you'd have bumped into me, there'd have been a mushroom cloud. I mean, I was paranoid as hell. I had people after me, man. If I get what I deserve, you better not be sitting next to me. And this guy come up to me. Little guy. He wasn't short enough to be a midget or tall enough to be a man. He had hair and had a welder's hat pulled down over one ear, had strawberries and cherries in it, had long hair, it had thongs on it, he painted his feet black with shoe polish so it looked like he had socks on. I said, how could you do this? I don't like to do laundry. I said, how about your shorts? Oh, yeah. I said, what do you want? He said, will you be my sponsor? Oh, jeez. Jeez. I really made God mad somewhere. Oh, my sponsor standing over the corner telling newcomers, hey, he'd call a newcomer over and say, see Keith over there? If you keep drinking, you're going to end up like him. I was the group's best worst example. I went over to my sponsor. I said, "See that guy?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "He just asked me to be his sponsor." My sponsor said, "I know. I sent him over there." He said, "You go over there and tell him you'll do whatever anything he wants to do, and you'll be his sponsor." If you question your sponsor when it comes like, they get irate and a little vein pulsates in their head and they spit on you. So my sponsor said, "I got to be your sponsor. What do you want?" "I was 3.5 years sober, baby. You want to know how good I'm doing? I just got out of the hospital. I got new blood. I got an AA car. I got a Lincoln out there, Mark IV Lincoln. Got a hood long and a horse dream. Parked right in front of the meeting. You want to know how I'm doing? Look at my car. Yeah. Look at my car. Yeah. That's how I'm doing. Look at my car." That guy said, "I want to ride home." I said, "All right, you go out that door. I'll go out this door. I'll meet you in my car." He said, "I don't want to do that. I want to go with you." He grabbed me by the arm. We started out the door. Two guys I knew, the only two friends I had. We get to the door, and this guy says, "Keith's my sponsor." I said, "Don't tell people I'm your sponsor." Then boy said, "Boy, it's going to be fun to watch you two grow." Yeah. I got him in the car. First thing he said when we got in the car, he said, "Let me tell you something." I said, "Okay." And he tells me this sick crap. And he says, "You ever do anything like that?" I said, "Yeah." And I start telling some of my stuff. He said, "Whoa, you're sick, man. We need to go to a meeting." We are. I go get him. Let him out of his house. Pick him up later. He looked like he just stood inside the door. I said, "Why don't you call me Harry?" He said, "I did." "Hell, you did. I'll be damned." "All right, get in the car." And he said, "How about this?" And he'd lay some other sick crap on me. And he said, "You ever do anything like that?" "Yeah. I'm telling him my sick stuff." We went to a meeting, heard Chuck Chamberlain, the great water walker, and he laid it on us. We're in the front row like a couple of monkeys, man. We're getting it. We get out in the car, and this guy says to me, he said, "We need a miracle." I said, "What?" "Yeah, like a burning bush. We need a sign, parting of the water or something." If I had some lighter fluid, I'd torch that hedge over there. I had a .45 automatic in the glove box. I run around in the chamber. I said, "Tell you what, Slick." I put it upside his head. I said, "I'll tell you what. You count to 10. While you're doing that, pray. Because if I don't have a floating resentment, decide to pop a cap on your ass, you just did step 3. Hey! You think I'm kidding you? That sucker's still sober, and them guys have seen him, and they've seen some of the other bent fenders I get. Get the message. Get down with the heathens, baby. He come over to my house. And he knocked on a door. By then I got a new house, moved in a new neighborhood, had a blacktop driveway. I'm in there doing 14-step, humming, doing a little transcendental meditation. I got a gi on with no underwear. Come to the door, had a big book. I said, "What do you want?" He said, "I want to work the steps like you did." I said, "Yeah. Okay." I said, "Well, I'm powerless, so come on in. My life's unmanageable because you're here. You're crazy and I'm crazy. We got to go in the kitchen, get down on our knees, and do the third step prayer." He said, "You going to put some shorts on or something, man? I mean..." Yeah. I went in there. We got down on our knees. He cuddled up underneath my arm. I had that tingling sensation and questioned my sexuality there. The cat walked by and looked at us funny. We said the third step prayer. Got up. He said, "Now I want to do my fourth step." And he got his book and pulled a bunch of blank papers out and threw them over there. They're blank. I said, "You're supposed to have something on it when you get your sponsor's house." He said, "I can't read or write." He threw me a pencil. He said, "I'll talk and you write." So he started talking. Started writing. Pretty soon he said, "Did you ever do anything like that?" And I said, "Yeah." I started telling him stuff. Whoa. We asked God in there. He can't read or write. I got a couple of things nobody knows about, so I just put some of my shit right there in here. Woo-hoo! Man, when God sends a trash barrel, put your junk in it. Get her on out. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We burnt that one. Hallelujah. I don't have to carry that no more. And he kissed me on the cheek, said, "I love you." Ran out the front yard in front of the neighbors and everybody. I said, "I love you." Up in his old car and rattled down the street. And standing in my front yard, it went from the head to the heart. It went from the head to the heart. I've done my fifth step with my sponsor, and that's half the deal. When I received that fifth step, the healing and the full circle were there. And it went from the head to the heart. If you're new, a relative new, you've been here a while, don't look for something that ain't here. Don't complicate this thing. We have one job, one message, one path. And that's to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety through a spiritual way of living to the new man. To give him hope. To give him hope. Sit there desolate, decisions, confusion, trauma, and tragedy to give you hope. To give you hope. Hope is simply a vision beyond your present circumstance. I go into prisons all the time. My wife and I, we've been together 50 years. We have a good relationship. My daughter, 46 years old. Just two little girls. They love me. They live in Italy. And she married an Italian man, a very good Italian, very good Italian man. The only flaw that I see is he works too much, but we can't hold that against him. She's never had to wire home for money since she's met that guy. And my little girls, two little girls, 3 and 10, and they call me Pappy. They love you, Pappy. And my daughter's come home and brought these little girls, and we go into prisons all the time. I joined the Hospital Institution Committee and started going into prisons when I was 6 months sober, lied and said I had a year, and started going into prison. I spent a lot of money to clean up my past, clean up my record, and through doing cleaning up my record and my past to go into the institutions, it allowed me to get a passport when my daughter moved to Italy, and I could go to see my daughter and my grandchildren. So doing the service of the hospitals and institutions, I'm much more comfortable there than I am here tonight. And if I'm going to do these things tonight, it's heady wine. Saturday night's heady wine. And my ass better be in some meeting in a detox or an institution next Wednesday. Or this will kill me. This will kill me. And I knew that. And I started going in those institutions. I went to San Quentin with some guys. With a doctor, a lawyer, some producer, a little gal come from Hollywood, had a little short skirt on. 300 convicts come in the room. And I heard the doctor say he went to school, almost lost his license, but he went to AA, saved his license, and thanks to AA, he's a practicing medical man. They heard the lawyer get up there. He said he went to school, passed the bar, came out into the community, got drunk, got in trouble. Came to AA, saved his license, got a profession. Heard the other professional man talk about Alcoholics Anonymous saving their life. And then the little gal with a short skirt got up, and everybody wondered what she had. Yeah. And they used up all the time, but about 3 minutes. And I'm sitting on the front row, San Quentin Prison. 300 convicts sitting in the back. And I got 3 minutes. And I say to myself, God, give me something to say to these people that they will identify with. And it came my 3 minutes, and I said, I'm going to tell you about me. I drank and used, and I'd been on a 10-day run, and I come home out of a blackout, and I laid on the couch, and I passed out. When I came to, my little girl was about 4 feet away, and the only friend she had, she'd brought a stray dog, a cocker spaniel dog, hair all matted, and she brought that dog in, and that dog was laying on her stomach, licking her in the face. And the jealousy and the rage inside of me that dog could love my daughter more than I could. The rage. I had a 9-shot 22 pistol. I shot that dog 9 times. Put the last shot in his eye, 6 inches from my daughter's face. My wife was standing 5 feet away, and nobody said a word. In San Quentin Prison, when I told that story, 300 convicts jumped up and said, yeah, you showed them. It makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. And I ain't got much. Because they live in that environment with that show me, I'll show you. But sitting here tonight when I told that story and stopped it was quiet. It was quiet and peaceful because you people are free. You have the key of the door you sleep behind. Don't ever take your freedom for granted. There's people in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings that live with the fear and the terror of the streets and try to stay clean and sober. I go into a women's prison. I've gone into there for 27 years. There's never been a dark night. I get people from my home group and we go to that prison. My wife's been going in there carrying the message of Al-Anon for 27 years. There's never been a dark night. We buy the insurance on our cars, put the air in the tires in our cars, buy the gas in the car we go in. We invite people, take good people in there, can respect the convicts. And we go in, we go through the gate, we walk the walk, we go to the meeting, and we carry the message. The first time my wife went in there as an Al-Anon, there was a lady in there doing life, double life. She came up to my wife and she said, "I'm doing a double life and I wasn't drunk when I committed the crime." My wife said, "Really, what happened?" She said, "My drunken husband was ranting and raving around the room with a gun and he shot our 9-year-old daughter. And then he passed out and I took that gun and I shot him and I couldn't prove I didn't kill them both. And I'm doing a double life and I was stone cold sober when I did that." And my wife said, "I can help you. Forgive yourself." Sitting in that meeting, these bunch of women killers, there's about 140 of them. There's mass murders. The Manson girls are in there. And my wife said, "I'm an Al-Anon." A junkie gal in the back stood up and said, "I'm a junkie. What can you do for me?" And I thought, "Oh, God. Baby, you better have an answer. You better have an answer. We're done." My wife said, "When you were out on the street slinging dope, did you have a mother and a father? And a brother or sister or children?" She said, "Well, of course I did." My wife said, "That's who we are. That's who we are. And if you'll stay in here and come to my meeting, I can teach you how we felt. And maybe you can forgive yourself. And maybe they can forgive you." And it was a beginning. It was a beginning. And I've been going in there and taking people into the AA meeting. And you got to know how to look. You got to know how to walk. You can't pass no kites. You got to go to school to learn how to do that. You walk into those institutions with those inmates knowing that they can set you up, they can put deals on you, and yet you walk with God because you're doing God's work. I went into this institution to have a Christmas party. And they bring all the church people and all these people in for the Christmas party. And they acknowledge all the volunteers. And have a big holding room where all these people come in. The day before, the morning that we were going to this Christmas party, I got a toothache. I mean, I got a toothache. When I get a toothache, I hurt. And when I hurt, I put my defenses up. And when I hurt like that, my defenses come up and I get mean and I back into a corner. And that tooth is throbbing and I said, "I can't go." And my wife said, "You're going. You're going. Get dressed. We're going." I got dressed, chewed on some aspirin, go out and get in the car, and we go in this holding room. It's about as big as that foyer out there. And there's all these preachers and people from the church all dooted out, and everybody, it's Christmas, everybody. And my tooth is going wham, wham, wham. And I backed up against the corner. And I've been watching this preacher man come in there. Young man. He told me he'd had trouble with drugs, and he found Jesus, and he got in this church, and he brings a church into that institution. He's a funny looking guy. Not a kind of guy I would really associate with that much. A nice guy, a clean guy. And every once in a while I'd ask him something about the Bible. You know, he'd talk to me. So when they come in that door, I recognize him. I'm backed up against the wall, my jaw's throbbing. And I said, "Come here." That preacher man come up to me. And I said, "Preacher man, my jaw's killing me. I'm telling you, I got a toothache that are ruining you." I said, "Will you pray for me?" Now I thought maybe when he gets over there and he's doing his thing, he'd say a little prayer. He grabbed me. "Jesus, save this man. Take this pain from, in front of all these people. Take this pain from this man so he can do your work. Holy Jesus." Everybody's looking at me. And the whistle blew and everybody took off. My wife come and got me. I'm trucking out there. We get down to our room, and all these inmates are running around down there, and they played music, and they started dancing. Pretty soon, I jumped up, and I started dancing, and the pain was gone. The pain was gone. The pain was gone. I was having a good time. Oh, man, this is bad. This is bad because that guy did that to me, and it worked. I called my sponsor. I called my sponsor when I got home, and I said, "You know that preacher?" He said, "Yeah, I know the guy." I said, "You know, my tooth was just killing me. He came over and he prayed for me right in there in front of all them people, and my tooth quit hurting." He said, "Well, of course." I said, "Of course." He said, "Yeah." He said, "You believed in him." Well, I did. I wasn't asking to pray for him, but I didn't believe in him. I believed in him. My sponsor said, "You believed in him, and it worked." He said, "Now get an appointment with the dentist and get that tooth pulled." And I did. A month goes by, and I know, oh, jeez. He's going to come in there. I'm going to have to tell him. So I'm in there in the holding room. Here he comes. He come right over to me. I said, "Preacher?" "Yeah." I said, "You remember Christmas when I had that toothache and you prayed on me?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "It worked." He said, "Well, of course it did. Of course it did." He said, "Don't ask me to do it again. Get that tooth pulled." I said, "It did." He said, "It worked because you believed. You believed. You believed." See, I don't know much about anything, but I know I believe. I believe. I believe God is all powerful. I don't know about God. I know God. He's worked in my life. Hallelujah, brother. He's worked in my life. I've changed. I'm not the same person I used to be. I don't even think like I used to think. I remember one time I was working on one of these committees, and I was stumbling along, and my job was to clean up when everybody left. I was a cleanup man. Had a newcomer with me, and my daughter's with me, and I'm cleaning up, and there were some people from over Hollywood had come on this committee, and I'm cleaning up around in there, and I see a purse down there, a man's purse, an organizer. Huh? And I grabbed that thing and I opened it up. It had money in it, checkbook in it, calendar, credit cards. I'm looking through it. Newcomer's watching me. My daughter's watching me. And I said, "Ah, shit. All right." I mean, if you can't hold on to your stuff, you don't deserve to keep it. Come on. But I got witnesses, so it belonged to a guy named Peter from over in Hollywood. So I took it home and I called Peter. "Peter, I got your purse." He was so happy. "Oh, my God, Keith, thank you." I said, "I'll come over there to the west side over at Santa Monica, the big meeting, and I'll bring your purse back tomorrow." So I get the newcomer and get my daughter over there. And we're standing in this big meeting, and Peter comes running up, and I said, "There." Peter looks in it, checks it all, everything's in it. "Oh, Keith, I'm so happy. I'm so happy. If there's ever, ever, ever anything I can do for you, just let me know." I'm thinking, "Peter, you can't even take your purse. For God's sake, you'll never be able to help me." But I didn't say nothing because I was sober long enough to keep my mouth shut. And he hugged me and went on my way. Sometime later, my daughter made a decision to move to go to Milan, Italy, and be a model. She looked beyond where other people feared to go because she knew there was no spot where God was not. And we took her down to LAX. Had all her stuff, had a one-way ticket and $100, got on a plane and went to Italy. She'd been around before, and we didn't hear from her. We didn't hear from her for 6 weeks. We didn't know whether she was dead or alive. Didn't know where she was. She couldn't speak Italian. She didn't have an agent. She got over there and she got sick and she got confused. And she finally tried to get a hold of Al-Anon. She tried to get a hold of Alcoholics Anonymous. She finally found some people from a Italian, English-speaking AA meeting, and they came and got her out of this place she was staying, and they took her to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. In that meeting, they sat in a circle. There were 16 people in there, and they took her in. It was a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but they took her in there. It went around the room, and everybody shared. When it got to her, she said, "I know that this is a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm an Al-Anon." And they said, "We're not so narrow-minded that we won't let you share if you'll talk program." And she knew how to do that. And she shared her story. And sitting in that meeting was Peter. Peter was supposed to go home. Peter was supposed to do something else. But Peter was over there modeling and taking pictures. And he came up to my daughter and he said, "Is your dad named Keith?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, 4 years later, "I owe him a favor." Now, I'm not so egotistical to think that because I did the next right thing that it saved my daughter's life. But I'm going to tell you this. At 7 years sober, if I'd have been the same asshole I was at 7 months sober, my daughter would have never reached out to Alcoholics Anonymous because she would have thought, "You're just like my dad and you'll be an asshole too." But because she saw the change in me, she reached out to you and you came and saved her life. I'm not so egotistical to think that because I gave that man back his belongings, he was there to help me. But because he stayed sober and he went on with his life and he never forgot that commitment to me because I'd done something for him, he was there for my daughter. He took my daughter, introduced her to agents, gave her his tapes. She learned the language. That's 27 years ago, 26 years ago. She's been there ever since. She started thousands of meetings. She's interpreted all kinds of literature. She's saved and touched thousands of people's lives. So started Al-Anon. She's a pioneer. She sponsors 20 women that have over 20 years in the program. She has this 12-step meeting over there in Italia. Book study. She's touched thousands of people's lives because of a moment in time. A moment in time. You see, that's the faith of the action of doing the right thing. That's the hope that I can change. I hope I can change. I don't know if I want to be like you, but I don't want to be like me. And I came out of that darkness. I came out of that evil living and thinking, and I changed. I changed. I changed. And I'm a kind and a gentle man. My daughter brought her little girl over here, and she brought her down to LAX. And I'm standing in that Bradley terminal. People from all over the world. I got tattoos all over me. I got a short sleeve shirt on. It's summertime. And my daughter came up that ramp, and she handed me that little girl. And that little girl's eyes are sparkling. And I danced around like an old fool. And I didn't care. I'm a grandpa. And I'm standing there. And the little girl's eyes are bubbling. And she's laughing at me. And I look at her mother. Oh, God. And I look at her grandma. And this little baby knows not the way I treated her mama. She knows not the way I treated her grandma. And she has no reason to fear me. She has no reason to fear me. I defy textbook. I've come from a total sociopath, a psychopath, to a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous with a kind and gentle heart. She's not afraid of me. She's not afraid of me. She's not afraid of me. God bless. Thank you very much.